Good morning. Well, sorry. Good morning, everyone. We'll get started. So welcome to the third meeting for this year. Just before we get started, just a couple announcements. From RFMS, Lorna Lorenzo has changed positions, so her funds are divvied up amongst other financial administrators in our office. CIHR research allowances are handled by Gertrude Vitesse. Interinstitutional grants are handled by Nancy Ferlano. And the CIHR student research awards are handled by Marissa Scrow. And you can check that in FTM Fund, McGill Fund Options. If you don't know who the FA is, you can always contact RFM Help Desk and we'll dispatch it to the appropriate FA. Okay. Another reminder from Travel Desk is the reimbursement of expenses policy, clause G4.4.6, summary of expense type, number 4, airfare. Seats in fare class greater than economy requires prior approval of the claimant's dean or vice principal or provost. So that needs to be attached to the travel advance or expense report when you submit it to the travel desk. And Amy, I guess you have other announcements to make.
So just quickly, you may have noticed that when we announced the 2014 session, we only announced the first three. So I just wanted to confirm that the next two sessions have been confirmed. The next one will be on Banner Student Aid System, the BISA system. This one will not be recorded, so you will need, if you want, we will be posting the presentation, the actual PowerPoint that's presented, but it won't be recorded, so if you can make it, we really recommend that you come. And any questions you may have, if you have specific questions, don't hesitate to send them to either Brenda or me, and we can give them to the presenter in advance if you have any specific BISA questions. And then in May, we'll be doing the other compliance. We've been talking a lot about financial compliance. Well, there's another compliance. There's research compliance, understanding the policies and processes governing research involving human subjects and animal subjects. So Linda McNeil and Claude Lalonde will be presenting. Linda's here today. It'll be essentially a panel presentation where they will talk about their processes and what to be aware of and how it impacts research administration and how you can help PIs with that process. Oh, and a few other notes. As you know, this time of year, a lot of the tri-agency awards and provincial awards come in, so we're getting into the busy time of the year. Right now, we don't know when the results will come in. NSERC usually comes in the last week of March, so any time now. We're expecting those ones. SHRC, as those people who work with SHRC awards know, that it has varied from last week of March to almost June. So sometimes the results come in early, sometimes they come in really late. We will keep everyone aware if we get any communication from SHRC that is going to be delayed, the announcement of the Insight Grants results, we will send it out to the RAN listserv so everybody knows. But this is the busy time of year, so it's a busy time of year for RFMS because of year-end reporting, as well as new fund creations. So for those of you who work in the departments, if you're not sure of the status of an award, check InfoEd first, because it will say if it's been approved or if we're waiting for documents, and then you can help us streamline the process, because we get the award results, but then we may need other documents from the PI that we've gone back and we're waiting for. So that's always a good way to check where things are in the process before contacting RFMS or OSR, wondering where it is. It'll give you a better idea of who to contact. And finally, for no-cost extensions, just a reminder that this is the time of year when people are submitting no-cost extensions, and I just wanted to remind people that how to write in a no-cost extension. A lot of PIs will write to the agency and say, because I have extra money. That's not sufficient, and what we've seen from the agencies in last few months is that they're pushing back on that and saying that that's not a sufficient justification, we need more information. So what you need to do is, if a PI is thinking of submitting a no-cost extension, most of the time they are approved, so there's that. So, I mean, it's worth the effort. But make sure that that it's aligned with how the activities that they will be conducting after. So that what the no-cost extension will allow them to do to support the research objectives. So if it's we want to put out a new, another publication, another journal article, hold a conference, things that are directly related to the reasons for which the grant was the grant or contract was awarded the funding in the first place. Is that's how you get a no-cost extension approved easily. If you just say, I have extra money left, the agency will say that's not sufficient and it'll result in a lot of communication. So if you can easily coach the PIs to write it that way, it will help streamline the process. And I think that's everything.
Yeah, I just forgot to mention for the travel reminder, if you have further questions, you can contact traveldeskhelp.acct@mcgill.ca. And they will accept only original signed memos, not emails, so that prior approval needs to be attached again to the travel advance or the expense report. Okay. So enjoy the session, Amy.
Yeah, I'll be the one talking. So, but then after this session, you won't see me talking for a long time. So if I did quite a few in the last little while, but then I take a break. So you'll get a break from me for the next few weeks or next few months. Now, we're going to talk about changes to eligibility and changes in status. I just want to go back. So we're going to talk about eligibility, changes of status scenarios. So I've created a bunch of scenarios, and then we can walk through the steps that need to take place. And then final remarks. I don't think that it will take the full 2 hours. However, I really want this session to be interactive. So if you have your own scenarios, your own cases that you weren't sure of the answer or what needed to happen, don't hesitate to put your hand up at any time. Give me your scenario. Obviously, don't tell me the PI's name because it's recorded, but you can give your scenario and we can walk through what needed to happen in those cases. So when it comes to research administration, we exist in finance, we exist in the research office or departmental support. But at the same time, there's the HR processes, the academic personnel office, and these impact how we can administer grants and contracts, how we do our jobs. But there's two cycles. So that's why I've put the award cycle from our presentation of last year, and then the little human resources, research administration, and APO, because research administration is tied to academic status. It's unavoidable. However, we're not always in that cycle or in that process, so therefore we need to find ways to better monitor changes in status. So what does eligibility mean? Eligibility applies to researchers throughout the research funding cycle, including eligibility to apply for funding, hold grant funding, incur research expenses. Now, throughout the presentation I may have mentioned grants, but it applies to contracts as well. When it comes to tri-agency, FRQNT and SC, OSR has the responsibility on behalf of McGill University to monitor eligibility. So every year we have to check every grant holder that holds grants, as well as for SHRC and CERC co-investigators as well. We have to confirm the eligibility of all of those people. So we have to go down. The agency provides us a list, and we have to check each person. And if there's been any changes, we have to notify the agency. So that's why we do that once a year. We do it for FRQNT and SC. We do it right now. We just finished it. For the tri-agencies, SHRC and NSERC, it's done September, October, and CIHR, I'm working on it right now. So because they only fall once a year, there are ones that fall through the cracks. We may not catch it until the next year. So we're trying to develop better processes so that we are monitoring this and we're not caught off guard. And for those, so that we don't have to go back and close out a fund or anything like that after the fact, we're on top of this throughout the process. Changes in eligibility may affect the researcher's ability to hold the award. Therefore, please contact OSR as early as possible. There used to be a lot of flexibility once it was awarded. A lot of agencies would be a bit more flexible on what they consider an eligible status. However, what we're seeing now is that if the researcher is not eligible, would not be eligible to apply if they tried to reapply, the agency may not consider them eligible to hold the grant if they already are holding one. So that's the threshold, that's the criteria to use. Should the researcher's status or eligibility change over the award period, or agency may need to be notified. So why do sponsor requirements and definitions for eligible researchers to apply for or appear as members of the research team, they may specify particular academic positions or appointment types. NSERC has some requirements in that regard. Some sponsors have requirements regarding citizenship. This is something that is confusing for us in the for those who have provincial grants. Tri-agencies do have no citizenship requirements whatsoever when it comes to grant funding. When it comes to student awards, they do have citizenship requirements, but for grant funding, they do not. Provided that the researcher is affiliated with an eligible Canadian post-secondary, regardless of what citizenship they have, they are eligible for grant funding. For the Fonds de Recherche du Québec, they must be a permanent resident or Canadian citizen. Now, they allow researchers to apply to the FRQ without meeting that criteria. However, they put that condition on future installments. So they may get year one or year two, but then after that, they have to provide proof that they're a permanent resident or that the that their file is under review with the citizenship office. Institutional requirements. Institutions have particular guidelines or requirements in order to be considered affiliated and eligible to apply for or hold grant funding. This varies from institution to institution, so usually if you talk to an agency and you say, is this person eligible to apply, they will always say, well, it depends on the institutional policy. Because some institutions have strict policies on who they will allow to submit, others do not. McGill is kind of in the middle. We don't have a strict policy on who can submit. Generally, provided that the department faculty agrees with the application going forward, it will go forward, provided that the person is eligible by sponsor guidelines. Most sponsors expect the institution to verify eligibility. If the application is submitted, the institution is confirming eligibility. So this is something that is important. There's always, if it turns out that they are ineligible, we can always pull the application back or talk to the agency and find a solution. But they do put that, most sponsors do put that on the institution. So when we're signing off on an application, we are signing that this person is eligible based on the guidelines and based on our own policies for eligible applicants. If a researcher is eligible to apply as PI, they are often also eligible to be the fund financial manager, the FFM, here at McGill. However, not always the case. Ineligibility to be an FFM does not necessarily mean that they are ineligible to apply. So in those cases, contact OSR. One example would be postdocs for SHRC in particular. Postdocs are eligible to apply for grant funding. However, they do not have, because they don't have an academic appointment here that would allow them to be an FFM, we assign the either their supervisor or the departmental chair as the account holder should it be awarded. But they would still be the grant holder from the agency's perspective. So what are common eligible appointment types? Professor. That one's pretty easy. That's full-time professor. Associate professor, assistant professor. These ones can be tenure stream or contract. Emeritus professor or post-retirement. And adjunct professor, which is an unpaid appointment. And if you click on the link there, you can see all McGill's academic classifications, because sometimes it can be really confusing. And it's actually well presented. So you get the hierarchy and everything of what comes, how those all relate. Now, what is an eligible affiliation? It depends. And if you ask an agency what is an eligible affiliation, they will say the same thing. It depends. And they will likely put it back to the institution to say, well, you have to sort it out. If you're saying it's eligible, we will generally take you at your word that this person is eligible. Generally, if the institution signs the application, the applicant is considered eligible, as I just said. When the department faculty signs the OSR checklist, they are confirming support of the application. This is what OSR uses as confirmation that all units agree with this application going forward. So that's one of the reasons why we're always chasing after OSR checklists, and we won't submit an application, deadline time, we won't submit an application until the OSR checklist has been received, because that provides the institutional confirmation. That provides the back supporting documentation for us to be able, as an institution, to submit that application to the agency. Some special considerations include, as I said, some funders allow students, postdocs, to apply for grant funding. We will submit those, provided that the supervisor agrees to be the fund holder if the grant is awarded. NSERC, researchers on a contract stream, which is non-tenure, must hold an appointment of at least 3 years in duration. This is something that does come up every year when we do the eligibility list, so that if a researcher's contract is renewed, it has to be renewed for 3 years. Now, the agencies, I've talked to the agencies, and they've clarified that if the 3 years would extend beyond the grant, they don't necessarily, it has to be 3 years or the end date of the grant. So when the grant will close out, this person has to be affiliated for that time, or if it's just the grant has just started or it's going for 5 years, they have to have a 3-year appointment. If, and it has to be continuous. So this is where it's very confusing, that if the term ends September, at the end of September, October 1st, the next 3-year term has to start. Otherwise, they do become ineligible for the grant funding. There is the agencies do allow 3 months. The tri-agencies allow 3 months where you are not allowed to incur expenses, but they don't claw that grant back yet. So you have a three-month window. If you can provide an eligible appointment by that time, you get to keep the grant. And researchers who have not yet taken up their position at McGill, there are some cases where they'll be applying for the SHRC CIHR excerpt, for example, and they haven't yet come to McGill. In those cases, we will often submit the application, provided you know we deal with those on a case-by-case basis. What are considered changes in eligibility? Changes in academic status. So ones we see a lot are a professor retires, or a professor takes up an adjunct status, which usually means they've left and they're going to remain as an adjunct. Changes from assistant professor to associate professor or associate professor to professor, those ones rarely need to be reported to the agency because they're still full-time paid appointments at McGill. It's not a bad idea to have the researcher follow up with the agency so that they update their records, but otherwise they rarely have to be reported. If you're ever not sure, though, of course, contact me. Position changes from paid to unpaid, that's when the agency absolutely has to be notified. Now, when it comes to leaves from the university, research, sabbatical leave, personal, parental leave, unpaid leave, leave of absence, it depends on the actual funder. So contact OSR if you're not sure. The tri-agencies, they allow leaves of any kind for up to 1 year. And they don't have to be reported to them. If they're over a year, then the person becomes ineligible. So contact me if you have any questions. Now, why does the agency want information on changes of eligibility? Because when I'm doing the eligibility list every year, this is what when I follow up with PIs, this is the answer I get. Why do they want that information? Well, they want that information to ensure that the research they are supporting continues to be undertaken. So if a researcher takes a leave of absence for 2 years and won't be at the university, they want some confirmation that the project is either continuing or the project's on hold and will be continued upon their return. It may affect the achievement of expected outcomes, may also modify the institutional support, access to facilities to conduct the research project, and they may have, the agency themselves may have restrictions on work being done in certain foreign locations. Some of them do say that you can't, without agency approval, you can't be located in certain areas doing research. It does not necessarily mean that the funding will be terminated, but it may result in revised award parameters such as the deferral of payment, modifications to eligible expenditures, or a change of PI. When do leaves need to be reported? For the tri-agencies, only leaves exceeding 1 year must be reported to the agency. After 1 year on leave, the grant holder may no longer be eligible. So an example is a grant holder takes a leave of 18 months. They would be eligible to continue to hold their grant for until the 1 year mark. So once it's 1 year plus a day, they're no longer eligible. There are the agency, in a few cases, the agencies have been accommodating, depending on what type of leave it is. So it never hurts to ask. However, at the 1 year mark plus a day, they consider that researcher is no longer eligible to be grant holder. And they will either encourage them to find a new PI, a co-investigator, to take over the grant, or the grant may need to be terminated. FRQ, new researcher grants, only unpaid leaves exceeding 3 months. If you look in the, this is something I've been dealing with a lot lately, because if you look in the FRQ guidelines, it says any type of leave, regardless of duration, must be reported to the agency. So I've been reporting them all to the agency as they requested, and now they came back and said, no, actually, we only need to know about unpaid leaves. for new researchers. So if the if in a new researcher grant, the researcher is taking maternity leave, a sick leave, sabbatical leave, those are okay. But if it's any type of unpaid leave or leave of absence where they will be located outside of Quebec, because a lot most researchers, when they take a leave of absence, they take up a visiting fellow somewhere else. In those cases, they would want to be notified. And for team grants, you should contact me in OSR, because they, it's generally speaking, they won't cancel the grant if the person's on leave. However, because it's a team grant and there's lots of other activities taking place, it's not just a single program of research, the agency does want to confirm that the project is still continuing. If they think that if they have concerns that it may not be continuing at the pace that they would like during the researcher's leave, they may recommend that one of the other co-investigators take over, either temporarily. Like for the next 8 months, the PI will be this person, and then contact us again and we'll put it back if you need to. U.S. federal, all leaves exceeding 3 months must be reported to the agency. This does include, this does include maternity leaves, parental leaves, everything. So if it's any type of leave, for U.S. federal, you should be contacting OSR as soon as you have any indication that the researcher may be taking a leave. You should contact OSR so that we can assess. And for all other agencies, contact OSR. Consult agency terms and conditions. Some will say that you cannot take a leave. You must be taking up a paid position at a Canadian university, for example. If it's something like that and the person's taking a leave of absence, they may not be eligible anymore. But contact OSR, and we would assess. Though for most non-tri-agency, it's a good assumption that you have to report the leave. Especially if it's over 3 months, I would say the threshold would be, if it's a leave over 3 months, then we should take it seriously and we need to look at all of their grants.
And for, I have to talk loud so that they can hear me. So for U.S. Federal, they will ask that there be an interim PI named. They will not authorize the PIs to keep their grants if they are on leave for more than 3 months. There will have to be an interim PI named on U.S. federal grants.
And by interim PI, we don't just mean someone, because there was confusion on this recently, it's not just someone taking over signing authority of the account, it would be someone taking over the intellectual direction and the reporting to the sponsor. So there's two things that are going on there. So the person may be on leave and assign signing authority to someone while they delegate signing authority to someone else for their account. That's not the same as informing the agency and having a change of PI. Just wanted to make that clear. And if it happens that the researcher will be delegating signing authority for a really long amount of time because they won't be here, that is a case where maybe it would be advisable to have a different PI, if possible, take over the intellectual direction of the project for that period to make sure that it just makes it, because the agency may want to know. Now, considerations for leave. When a ward holder is on leave, travel related to supervisory or academic duties is not usually considered an eligible expense to be charged to research funds. For example, if they're traveling, they're located in, I don't know, California for their leave, and they're traveling back to Montreal, but the justification they provide for that travel expense is to meet with my graduate students, that's not acceptable. If it's to meet with the project team to discuss project aims, that may be eligible. However, if it's just for academic duties, like to attend the annual meeting of the department or supervise graduate students, those are part of academic duties, so they would not be eligible. Generally speaking, they should not be charged to research funds. Contact RFMS or OSR if you ever have issues or questions about that. And as I mentioned, PI may opt to delegate signing authority to another member of the research team. But this is important. The PI still remains the grant holder from the perspective of the sponsor if they've only delegated signing authority. So they're ultimately responsible for the conduct of the project and the use of funds. So even if they're on parental leave and they're not necessarily at the university, they are still the grant holder for that project. So regardless of if they're located here or not, whatever happens during that period, they're still responsible for. And if the PI has taken family or sick leave, often a no-cost time extension or deferral may be required in order to complete the work. Don't hesitate to contact one to request one well in advance. When I worked at SHRC, I always thought that was strange to me that people would submit extension requests at this time of year, so the grant's going to term in, you know, a few days, and would say, well, I was on sick leave for 2 years. Okay, you could have asked us when you came, when you knew at that point that the research, your research project was going to take more time. There's nothing wrong with asking them. If you know right, if you know at that point, like you've taken, the researcher has taken a parental leave and is just coming back now, it's been a year. Well, they know that their research plan is probably changed, so there's nothing to stop them from going back to the agency and asking for a no-cost extension at that point rather than trying to rush at the end and then asking it at the last minute. For any, in most cases, if it's related to personal leave, sick leave, most sponsors are receptive to no-cost extension requests for that, and they will give them well in advance. In fact, they usually appreciate knowing at that time. So on to the scenarios. Scenario one, professor is retiring and has inquired what will happen to their research funds. So what needs to happen? You need to gather a list of active awards, confirm with PI if research projects will continue or be termed early, and if they say they want the projects to continue, we need to confirm with the department faculty that they continue to support the PI's program of research. Because when McGill is accepting a grant or recipient of a grant, we are confirming that the person has the facilities and resources to be able to complete the project. If the intention is that this person no longer has an office, no longer has a right to supervise students or whatever, we're not really in compliance with our requirements on that grant. So that's something that we need to be aware of. Generally speaking, though, the departments have no issue with the grants continuing. But that's their decision. OSR, they just communicate with OSR their decision, and then we proceed as required. So we contact OSR explaining the situation. OSR follows up with agencies as required, and award parameters revised as required. Most of the time, it's a very easy process. They may require a letter from the institution confirming that we continue to support the application and this researcher continues to be affiliated. But after that, it's usually the grant continues or the award continues as usual. Any questions on that one? That one's pretty straightforward. So retiring professors, as I said, may elect to terminate research funds and phase out their program of research or continue their program of research. They have right, as that position, as a retired prof, they do have authority to continue their research should they elect to. There are some that just say, no, I don't want to, and they close it all. They close out their lab and they fully retire. That's their decision. Now, these professors are eligible to be fund holders, provided the agency authorizes a change of status. They may be eligible to keep the grant. Department faculty must confirm that the researcher continues to have access to facilities to conduct the research and is authorized to supervise students. Because if you can't do those two things, then there's no reason why you'd have research awards, because there would be nothing to support. And then this is very, very important. If the researcher will be primarily located elsewhere during their retirement, institutional authorization is required to move any equipment or research materials. So they're going to continue, let's say, for example, they're going to continue to be affiliated with McGill, but for a variety of reasons, they want to move to Ontario. They can do that, and they can continue to be affiliated with McGill. However, if they're also, while living in Ontario, going to be doing their research there and intend to move the contents of their lab or any research data that has been collected, that's something that the institution needs to be aware of. And they can't just do that. They can't just pack up their lab and leave. The department and the faculty have to be involved, and because it could have implications on permits for materials, ethics, even insurance. Insurance is a big one, because any equipment purchased, correct me if I'm wrong, any equipment purchased falls under McGill insurance, and therefore if McGill's insurance has it as located in this lab and then something happens and it turns out it was not there, there's an issue there. So in the faculties and the departments in those cases, it should be doing inventories of the goods and then confirming in writing everything that's being moved so everyone's on the same page. Scenario two, professor informs department. Oh, sorry, yes.
In when does OSR know that the professor is on sabbatical or retirement.
When you tell us. Sorry, the question was, when does OSR know that the grant holder is on any leave or retired? Most often we find out by flu. If we're not directly told by someone in the department, we usually find out just in passing that the researcher may mention that, oh, well, I'm retired, so don't call my office, you know, something like that. That's how we find out. We do, as I said, we do those lists of ongoing eligibility, so we would catch it at least once, like within the year we would catch it, but we would not necessarily catch it immediately. A lot of departments and faculties are getting much better at this, and so when the lists of who's going on leave, who's retired, they send us that long list, and then we evaluate and we follow up with the PIs. That's not the case in all departments and faculties, and it hasn't been mandated that OSR needs to be involved, but that's generally how we find out. Yes? Yeah, yeah.
It's going
to be an actual, but I have a book that I don't do those appointments. Exactly. Well, that's the thing, and so I'm pretty sure most people in the room are in the same situation that it was. Like, it's not just an OSR problem. And so it's a matter of putting yourself out there, you know, letting people know that you need to be aware. I mean, you don't have to be involved in the process, but once the letters are confirmed, that you're copied on that letter, or it's forwarded to you for your records, it is an issue, and that the HR processes happen over here, and the research administration happens here, and sometimes the only way it's caught when PIs depart is they may not be eligible to be a fund holder anymore. You know, and so the error report kicks them out as you can't be a fund holder anymore, and that's the only time we've found out. We're getting a lot better, but even so, we've still had to report to the agency recently researchers who had left a year ago, or, you know, it just never came up, because if nobody alerts us, no, you know, and often the researchers assume that we would just know, that we would just know to close out that grant, we would just know that, you know, so they haven't necessarily touched the funds, so that's good from an institutional perspective, because there's no ineligible expenses that have been incurred, but a lot of people assume that the process happens when it actually doesn't. And so, I mean, OSR has been doing a lot to put ourselves out there to say we need to be notified, and there's nothing to stop people at the faculty or department level to talking to your counterpart that works on these or that knows about changes of status to say, just let me know, or, you know, we could have a working list of every month you send me a list of any changes you've processed. That's the only way, unfortunately. Anything to add? That's good. Okay. Yes.
Financial officer need to be the AAs. Why financial officer? Because AA is starting process. Because the professor and the department. Mm-hmm. So why don't the financial officers advise AAAs to contact FS teams, for example? Because this is what I did. I changed department, I told the AA. Let me know his email, but financial officer meet with AAs. So it could be a communication.
I'm looking at Elfie because that would be more of a procedural question.
Because the FSTs and some of the grant communities maybe report to the FFOs indirectly, but especially the FSTs, since you report to FFOs directly, there's nothing stopping you from advising or meeting with your FFO and saying, when there's a leave, when retirement occurs and it's a principal investigator, I need to know. Mm-hmm. So then they can put something in place to advise all FSTs when these leaves occur, mm-hmm. so that you're in the loop. It shouldn't be the FFO, the AA, and then the FSD. It should be the FFO to the FSD, because you report directly to the FFO. So you should have those discussions with the FFO. And they should put a process in place so that you're in the loop.
But when you meet with the FFO, is it that they know that you will be doing that? When you have a meeting with them, this has been come to the table as well? Because I can address it to my FFO, but when all are together, they have meetings with Centra. Is this an issue that has been addressed?
Well, it's not an issue because the FFOs are not directly related to research administration, so we haven't brought that to the FFO monthly meetings. Mm-hmm. But you have, I suppose you have meetings with your FFOs, mm-hmm. so these types of topics are coming up and you should be discussing these with your FFOs. But mm-hmm. we can bring that to the next FFO meeting. That's a great idea, and I think we'll put that on the agenda so you're aware. Good point.
And at this time of year is when most of the changes of status happen. People are tending to give their resignations or requests for leave at this time of year. So it's not a bad idea to talk to other people in your departments and faculties to say, you know, bring me into this conversation, copy me on messages, because you need to know. Any other questions on this? Clarice. Oh. good question. It's oh, here, I'll say it into the microphone so it gets the FFO is Faculty Financial Officer. Now I feel like I'm on, and the other one was Administrative Assistant. Yeah. Good question, though. And on that note, if ever there are acronyms thrown around and you do not know what they are, please put your hand up and let me know. So on to scenario two, where the professor informs the department faculty that they have accepted a position elsewhere and will be leaving McGill. Sometimes this is done well in advance. Sometimes it's done well after they've taken up a position elsewhere. What often happens is there's what we see a lot of is researchers, because they are eligible to take a leave of absence of up to a year on tri-agency without notifying the agency. Because they're allowed to take a leave of absence for up to a year without notifying the tri-agency, they will take a year leave. And it's an unpaid leave from McGill. So they take a position elsewhere, decide if they like it, and then at the one-year mark, then they resign. This is what happens a lot. In fact, for those that deal a lot with this, it's most of the cases. In those cases, they are still eligible to hold the grant for that year leave of absence for tri-agency, so it would be the resignation date would be valid as of the one-year mark. So in those cases, what happens? So what happens next? Well, you need to assess the active awards. So this is where we want the department's faculties to sit down with those researchers to say, here we see all your active funds. What's going to happen with these? Do you want to transfer them? Do you want to change a PI? Do you just want to terminate them? And then when you have the preliminary next steps determined, then you contact OSR, you contact me, and we would assess this, and I would assess the sponsor requirements, contact stakeholders, sponsor RFMS, whoever needs to be brought into it, and then RFMS would prepare the financial reports, return transfers, unspent funds to sponsor a new institution. So this is how we... So that's what... Right now, it's me. Right now, I'm doing... both the first two steps, but now that we're getting more people with knowledge of agency terms and conditions, I'm hoping that we can have it so that the PIs have a resource, the department or faculty level, so that you can sit down with them. And I'm happy to help in that conversation to determine what needs to happen. And it also helps because sometimes PIs have ideas on what they can do and not do with the funds, like I'm going to keep that grant. Well, you may not be able to keep that grant. So before they get too far into their planning and they commit to students or make plans for the remaining years of the grant, we need to have that conversation to make sure that they're all aware of the obligations. So when it comes to scenario two, you have four options, essentially. You can transfer the award to the new institution if the new institution is eligible to receive the award, and it's always subject to agency approval. You can change the PI, transferring the award to another research team member. You can leave the award at McGill but hold an adjunct status. This one's subject to agency authorization and eligibility requirements as well. Or you can terminate the award. In some cases, researchers, grant holders will want to terminate. They'll say, especially with provincial, they mostly terminate. They don't transfer to another PI or anything like that. They'll just say, "That's fine. I don't need that award anymore. You can close it out." So that in that case, we would notify the agency and close it out. But I'm going to go into drill down into what needs to happen in each of these scenarios. So if the PI resigns from McGill and wants to transfer the award, the request to transfer submitted to the agency requests confirmation from the new institution that they accept the grant and a financial statement from McGill. Now McGill then has to prepare the financial report effective the resignation date, returns either to the agency or the new institution any unspent funds from the account, and then the new institution requires all the documents from the PI in order to build the file and authorize fund opening. So essentially the new institution, they start their award process just as we do for new awards. So for them it's a new award, so they'll need the proposal, they'll likely need the notice of award that was originally issued, but the new one will be issued to them as well, and any type of OSR checklist that they have. Most institutions have some type of routing slip, so they would require that as well. And then the agency issues the revised notice of award to the institution. Grant start date is usually the appointment start date. One other point to note for, so the request to transfer is submitted to the agency. McGill gets working on its requirements. Most often, this is, most often, the new institution won't start this, won't provide the letter until these documents are there. So there can be a bit of a lag. So it's always good if you know the PI is intending to transfer the award to put them in contact with the research office there as soon as possible so that they can start building the file, because most will not provide the confirmation that they accept the grant until they have a complete file there. And yeah, and this is something that's very important. PI must notify OSR that they want to transfer the grant and the effective date of the transfer. Grant isn't automatically transferred if the PI leaves, especially for Tri-Agency in Canada. There are still some researchers that assume that that process just happens, like we know to issue it to University of Toronto. Well, no, we can't just turn around and mail all the money to Toronto. It has to go to the agency. They make a decision. Then Toronto gets involved. So it isn't an immediate process, but we try and make it as smooth as possible. PI resigns from McGill. Change of PI. If the PI... if I can... Just, yeah, remember the smiling face with the arrow, because this is the one we really recommend. If ever the PI cannot transfer the award, like let's say it's a tri-agency and they're leaving Canada, this is the one that they should opt for. If the PI is resigning and will not be eligible to continue to hold the research funds, they can appoint a new PI. Usually it's a co-investigator who's already involved in the project, so they just promote the person from co-investigator to PI. Provided that the co-investigator is eligible to be the grant holder, it's almost always accepted by the agency. If there isn't a co-investigator, they can request someone else to take over. They would add them as a co-investigator and simultaneously add them as the have them as the PI. The one consideration in that situation would be it'd have to be someone that knows the research well enough to be able to lead the intellectual direction of the project to the project completion. It can't just be, I don't want to lose this grant, so my colleague next door is going to take it over. That colleague has to be able to, has to have the capacity to be able to do the research and lead the project. New PI, and then new PI should be informed of status of funds, including reports submitted, pending revenues received. This is particularly the case if they elect to do a change of PI on a contract. On a contract, both the PI, the current PI, and the proposed new PI should sit down and go over, have all revenues been received, have all deliverables been met? If not, who's going to be responsible for meeting those deliverables? Will I have sufficient information to submit that report or submit that deliverable? And if there are, McGill has advanced spending power for payment and payments have not all been received, so there's technically an over expenditure in the file that nobody knows about. For those cases, it's encourage that the department, the FST, talk to RFMS to get how much revenue has been received and then how many expenses. So it may the account, when the PI looks at the account, they think they're okay because they have unspent balance, but it may not be an unspent balance because we may not have been paid of that amount, like 30K, we may have only been paid 10. So they actually do have an overexpenditure, which is just hiding under the hiding in the way it's set up in Banner. So in that case, all those PI, like that new PI, has to agree to that, because you don't want to have, you don't want that person to be penalized with an overexpenditure at the end if we don't get paid, when in fact it wasn't really his or her fault. They just inherited it. So those are conversations that need to happen, and OSR would be involved in that conversation as well. Once approved, OSR revises the award parameters. If the org code will be changing as a result of the change of PI, a new OSR checklist will be required, and the org code will be changed for the fund. But we don't change the InfoEd record, right?
Normally not.
Okay.
Exactly. Normally we would keep the same fund number, but we would change the department...
yeah. The departmental org?
Exactly. But if there is a new PI, that new PI should be completing a new checklist, because they are taking on responsibility of that grant. So any changes in PI would require that new PI to sign the checklist. If they're within the same department, there's no need to get the chair's signature again to sign, or the ADR to sign. If we're switching departments, then all the departments, the both departments, have to agree that, yes, this is changing org. And if it's changing to another faculty, then we all need to get even more people involved, because we want to make sure that the faculties are aware that this grant or this fund is changing. And the other thing, too, as Amy was mentioning, when there's a change in PI, for grants that have annual technical reports, NIH, a lot of our grants, a lot of our biomedical type of grants have annual reports, some have quarterly reports. So it's important that the new PI knows that, hey, you're going to have an annual report that's due in 6 months. Do you know what happened the 6 months prior when you weren't leading this project? Do you have all the data you need to proceed with that annual report or that quarterly report or whatever? So it really is important when there's a change in PI that the new PI be told clearly what's up with this. What are the terms of that award?
Yeah, and for change of PIs, I'm looking at Linda, but the ethics would need to be revised as well to have the new PI as the lead, correct? Yeah. Yeah, sorry. I realized as Marley said it, I was thinking like, oh, the ethics certificates too. So yeah, anything like that, basically that new PI is taking over all responsibility for all the conduct of research under that project. So the PI resigns from McGill, but they want to hold an adjunct status. This is quite common. This is the time of year when we're getting all these questions, and I get a lot of them. I'm sure some of you get them too. Some sponsors will allow the grant to remain active at McGill if the PI continues to hold an adjunct status. If the PI wants to pursue this option, the following steps need to be undertaken. They need to check their ongoing awards. Is an adjunct status eligible to hold funds? Contact OSR for more information. As a general rule, if they would not be eligible to apply to that funding opportunity with their adjunct status because of criteria, you have to be in Canada or something like that, they would not be eligible to hold the grant. PI needs to talk to the chair, dean, to explore the possibility of an adjunct appointment. Adjunct appointment must be processed via regular appointment channels, confirmation provided to OSR, and then OSR would write to the sponsor requesting authorization. Decision rests with the sponsor. They could still, even though it's technically eligible, they could still say, no, we don't accept this request. The important thing to note is that step one is contact OSR to see, check the award parameter, the award terms and conditions, and contact OSR, because sometimes it may not be an eligible status. So before they do all these steps to get this person an adjunct status, we need to know, is it even worth it? Can they even keep that grant? What happens sometimes is the adjunct status process will happen, then OSR will be involved, and then OSR is stuck where, well, we can certainly request authorization from the sponsor. I mean, it never hurts to ask, but a lot of sponsors now are reviewing these requests more carefully than they used to be. Now, talking of reviewing these requests more carefully, we're on to the tri-agencies, who used to pretty much allow adjunct status. If you took up a position outside of Canada, but you held an adjunct status, you could be eligible. Now it's not so much. NSERC, absolutely not. The agency has confirmed that if you take up a position outside of Canada, even if you continue to hold an adjunct status in the three-year contract, it is not eligible. The grant will have to be terminated as of the resignation date of the primary appointment, though ongoing commitments may be authorized. CIHR, it depends. So they will consider that request, provided that the researcher meets certain eligibility criteria. In all these cases, contact OSR and we can assess. For SHRC, it is really confusing. If you go to the Tri-Agency Financial Administration Guide, it says, yes, you can. Adjunct statuses are eligible. However, when you go to the program descriptions for Insight grants, Insight development grants, and standard research grants, it specifically says adjunct appointments are not eligible if the researcher will be located outside of Canada. So the Tri-Agency Financial Administration Guide currently says, SHRC, you can. This is acknowledged. This was acknowledged to me by SHRC Finance that this was an error. But they can't update. They only update the Tri-Agency Financial Administration Guide once a year. So it's in the queue to be updated. So right now, if you tell a researcher, no, you can't, they will go to the Tri-Agency Financial Administration Guide and they'll say, but it says I can. So this is my life. This is just going back and forth with them to say, yes, but the agency is clarified. And we do have that in writing from the agency that for Insight grants, Insight development grants, and standard research grants, your only options, if the researcher is leaving Canada, the only option is to transfer it to another PI, to have someone else take over as PI, or the grant's terminated. For other cases, it is on a case-by-case basis. Yes.
So what is located outside of Canada mean? Physically located, have a full appointment outside of Canada?
This is something that the agencies, they struggle with as well. In the case of, they used to say, you had to be located in Canada, like you didn't necessarily have to draw a paying position from Canada, but you had to be located in Canada. So you could have an adjunct status, but you would be living in Canada 6 months of the year. Now it's basically if you are drawing a salary from, if your primary salary is from a non-Canadian institution, you are considered no longer in Canada. There used to be some flexibility on what was a primary appointment. Now they're saying that if your salary is drawn from an institution outside of Canada, that's your primary appointment. Now there are some cases, especially in SHRC, because they allow virtually every appointment to apply. So there are some that maybe have jobs here, but then jobs elsewhere. If they're working 50-50, how do you determine, you know, if they're teaching here but they're teaching in Vermont because, you know, they need to make ends meet? Are they primarily located here, primarily located elsewhere? In those cases, I know that SHRC has gone to the researcher and asked them to prove a Canadian address. So if they could prove that they have an apartment in Montreal, then they were like, okay, I think that that's okay. I mean, is that technical? No. But in a few cases where it did come up where it was clear as mud, as Marlene would say, on where this person is actually primarily located, they did go that far. If it's that type of case, though, OSR should be involved. And I know we always look into these. So let me know if you're ever not sure. Is that clear for everyone? I know for NSERC, this is an ongoing issue. NSERC, until 2012, would allow adjuncts to hold grants after they left Canada. So it's created a situation where some are eligible to continue to hold their grants, but any new cases are being denied. So obviously researchers are a bit confused because they hear of other cases in the department where it's been allowed. Well, it was allowed under the old rules, and they've been grandfathered. Moving forward, no new requests would be allowed. Yes?
If somebody leaves the university outside of Canada, and the adjunct status is not, they don't allow them to hold grant, easily you would transfer over to your co-investigator. But if your co-investigator already holds...
Oh, yes, good point. Yeah, actually, yeah. The multiple application rule would apply to the co-investigator. So if the co-investigator already holds an insight grant or a standard research grant that hasn't yet termed, the multiple application policy would apply to them just as it would to the PI. So if they already hold one, they cannot hold another. And if they don't hold one right now and it is transferred to them, they cannot reapply until that one is done. So that is something to keep in mind too, because if it's a project that's not exclusively related to their program of research, they're committed to that project until it's done, and then they can ask for funding for it to support their own research. I mean, it never hurts to ask. I mean, if you can make a compelling justification, particularly in terms of student support and how it's supporting Canada, it never hurts to ask. Have I seen it allowed? No. No, I have not. yeah.
This might be very technical, but insight development grants, there's the two types, right? There's the emerging scholars and the regular scholars, and they're slightly different.
It's the same fund, same... That's okay, because it's the actual ID of the program that dictates. So they wouldn't look necessarily at if it was awarded under the emerging scholar or under the regular scholar. It is different envelopes of money, but it's the same program. So I've never seen them actually look that carefully at it. Usually they don't have issues with that. Any other question? Yes. Oh, what about CRCs? well, CRCs can't be transferred. Does anyone? They.
I would assume that they cannot be transferred because they're awarded to that individual.
Yeah. They have to be terminated, yes, but you have the ongoing commitments of up to 6 months that can be authorized, so they don't want to penalize students. So if their student salaries, for example, or research personnel encumbered on the fund prior to the resignation date, it can be paid up to 6 months after that date, just like NSERC and SHRC grants. Yes. I'll just repeat that. So the example given was they're using the CRC fund to pay postdocs. The postdoc has a one-year appointment, but the researcher's going to leave at a time when it would mean that they would not be able to fulfill the obligation of the one-year appointment. Is that correct? Okay. Yes. Yeah, if
it,
I think the yeah, so they can continue to be paid for up to 6 months after. However, if there's, like, let's say they leave 2 months into that 1 year appointment, so you get 6 months, but then that still leaves some time that we have this obligation of the postdoc. In those cases, I think it has to be discussed at the departmental level to see how that obligation is going. Either they terminate the contract and pay severance, or, you know, it's picked up on another fund. That'd be my assessment of that. Everyone agree with that? Looking around. Okay. But yes, it is something that we need to bring to grant holders' attention, that some researchers have the idea of leaving and they kind of phase out their program of research. You know, they may not take on new students, they may not apply for new funding. Those are the cases that are really easy for us to deal with. If it's more of a nobody saw it coming type departure, then there are discussions that need to take place at the departmental level to see how we're going to manage these research personnel and these obligations. Generally speaking, the agencies would not pick up any obligation beyond 6 months. They would see that as an institutional problem. Any other questions? We're good. Okay. And so as I said, you do have the ongoing commitments, so you have 6 months after. So the NSERC, for example, it would terminate the resignation date, but the account remains open. So if, it terminates the resignation date. So as of the resignation date, the PI loses authority to authorize expenses on that account. However, if there are salaries encumbered on that fund prior to the day when they lose their authority to authorize expenses, so they're still eligible to incur expenses, they can put through an appointment that's they can pay 6 months after up until that day. In those cases, how we process it in InfoEd and OSR is we will put the resignation date as the end date, so that if they left August 31st, the end date will say August 31st, and then in the terms and conditions of RFMS, we'll say ongoing commitment authorized until February 28th or whatever it is. Because the period for use of funds has actually terminated August 31st, the agencies have just allowed the institution to use the grant funds to pay obligations beyond that date, but no new expenses can be incurred. This is really important. It's not a phase-out period. It really is just so that we can pay our obligations. Any questions on that? Okay. I know we've talked about that many times. Grant termination. So PI for either they elect to terminate or they have to terminate. How does this happen? So this is option four. Sponsor is notified. OSR revises award parameters as required. RFMS prepares final financial report, and PI submits all required technical reporting. And we mentioned this at the last session. This is really important that that we make sure the PI submits all the technical reporting. If it's an agency that they will no longer be eligible to, the obligation on the part of the PI is sometimes not, they don't feel that obligation to submit that report because they no longer will be applying to that agency for the rest of their career. However, we as an institution need to make sure that it's been submitted, because the agencies will still notify us that that report is outstanding, and sometimes we have to chase after people into Australia, and we're trying to find them on Google to, you have to submit this report. And oftentimes, they don't even remember their awards password to get into that electronic system to submit the report. It's not easy to do once they've left, so it's really good to make sure that they've submitted all their reports. They've gone in, and the reports for most agencies are quite simple. It's just a matter of doing it. Just make sure they go into the system and they complete the report. Now, for contract termination, it's a bit different, because the first thing you need to do is you need to assess actual revenue received versus expenses incurred to date for active and recently termed contracts. I already talked about this with the change of PI, but if the contract is terming, we also, if the PI says, no, we're just going to terminate it, this is something we need to look into. And assess outstanding report status of deliverables. If there are outstanding deliverables, who will be responsible for them? And that's a discussion that needs to take place at the departmental level, faculty level. They need to decide how we're going to make sure that we meet this obligation, because if we don't submit a report or we don't submit a deliverable, McGill is in breach of the contract and they can claw back all that money. And it could go to court too. That's something we need to manage our risk or institutional risk on these contracts a bit differently than we would on a grant. Then sponsor notification as required. Usually it requires an amendment of some kind to be executed with the sponsor. And then fund closeout. I'm looking at Marlene. Was there anything else you wanted to say about contracts?
No, it was more for contracts, exactly. If once you pull, if any PIs who are retiring, who will no longer be keeping their research program, PIs who leave, pulling the list of their active or their recently terminated awards is critical. You need to really assess grants versus contracts. Contracts are a different beast to manage and to close out. And if there's residual funds, if the PI has residual funds, what happens with those? Do they revert back to the department? Do they revert back to the faculty? Those conversations need to be happening before the PI leaves. So it's really important to assess those two grants versus contracts differently.
Yeah, and with grants, if the grant has termed, there's usually no other action required except for ensuring that all the reports have been submitted. However, if a contract has termed, probably I'd say in the last year, what would you say is the threshold? Yeah, it's not bad. If you see,
the fund is still showing up on if the fund is still showing up on the report, then if it's not zeroed out, something's happening there. It needs to be zeroed out before the PI leaves. All their funds should be zeroed out. So the sooner you bring us in the loop, the sooner you bring RFMS in the loop, the better we can support you, guide you through the process, and assist with the process. But if we learn 2 days before they leave, it's really hard for us to provide that kind of support.
Mm-hmm. And that's unfortunately most of the time when we find that. So the earlier the better. So then scenario three is when a researcher is recruited to McGill. Again, that tends to happen this time of year. PI informs current institution, which follows process in scenario two, so they have to terminate all their grants or transfer their grants. All that stuff has to happen there. So there's two processes happening. The PI department works with OSR to establish the list of awards to be transferred to McGill. So the first step would be for the researcher there to talk to the research office at their current institution to get a list of everything. Once they've sat down and they've decided what's going to happen with all these awards, then they provide us with the list of the things of the awards that will be coming to McGill. Our current institution provides a list of active awards to PI and notifies the agencies. Agency issues new notice of OSR works with PI to prepare documents as required by the sponsor. For example, I said that most often they require some type of written confirmation from the authorized official at McGill saying we accept the award and we agree to the agency, to the terms and conditions. Occasionally they will actually have us sign a new grant agreement. It all depends. OSR will require copies of original grant application, notices of award, as well as an estimated unspent balance transferring to McGill. This is important, and the PI, the research office at the other institution can easily provide that, or can provide the unspent balance or the estimate of the unspent balance. We like that information because it allows us to assess how we can set up the award and if we can advance approve. And if we have the notices of award from the original award, and we know that which will allow us to know the budget period, so start date, end date of each budget period, the term of the grant, key terms and conditions. With that information, we can usually advance approve the creation of the fund, knowing that if we know that, let's say, April 1st, the grant is transferring, so we see in the notice of award what this researcher was supposed to get, April 1st or May 1st or whatever, we can then use that information to advance approve some of that budget, all of that budget. We assess on a case-by-case basis, but we don't necessarily wait until the official notice of award comes from the agency. We usually just proceed when the agency has said, yes, okay, thank you very much, we're just waiting for these following documents, then we'll process the request. Once the agency has acknowledged the request and given a favorable response, even if it's via email, it will usually allow us to proceed with a award approval.
So this is an important take-home message for that you can bring back to your FFOs, to your HR advisors, to the people in the departments and your faculties, that if there is new researchers coming in, please, you know, we're more than willing to help out so that they don't have these big gaps in fundings. They have their grants at their old institution. Unfortunately, it takes months before all the paperwork is cleaned up, before the accounts are closed, before the institute, before the agency releases the new notice of award. I mean, we're lucky if we're able to get this done in 2-3 months.
I would say six.
6 months?
Yeah.
So it makes no sense to have the PI wait for 6 months to have access to research funds. We know that those monies are secured. The agency is not going to pull the finding if they're coming to McGill. McGill is an established institution. So we can work with you to advance funds to the PIs to make sure that there is these gaps in fundings are not detrimental to their research program. So it really is an important take-home message to take to the people within your faculties and your departments to work with us when they have PIs coming in.
Yeah, it's a good idea to sit down to have like a research
Absolutely.
Administration meeting and sit down and say, and to go over McGill's key policies and what they need to be aware of, as well as next steps that need to take place for all their awards. A lot of researchers wait until they're here, then they set up their lab, then they contact OSR to say, where are my awards? Well, you know, it's a 3-6 month process to get it finalized. So we need to be involved as early as possible. So the agency issues a new notice of award. The OSR checklist will be required for each award transferring to McGill. OSR authorizes fund opening. And the reason why we asked for the OSR checklist is because they, although they've already accepted the terms of the agency, they haven't necessarily agreed to all of McGill's policies. And, you know, so this provides that confirmation. It provides the confirmation for us as well that they've agreed to all the research policies. So things to keep in mind when a PI is recruited to McGill. Marlene had a different ordering. I thought confidentiality was the first, but you can put these in whatever order you want. For me, PI's confidentiality is number one, because often, to do our jobs well, we need the confidence of the PIs. You know, we need them to be able to feel comfortable telling us things that maybe they don't want their other institution knowing, maybe they don't want even their chair knowing yet. So we need to always ask the PI before following up with their previous institution, absolutely, because often they'll contact us to see what needs to happen, but they haven't necessarily given notice to their new institution, or to their previous institution. Same thing when it's the opposite, when the PI's leaving. They may talk to you quietly in your office, you know, what needs to happen if I was to theoretically leave. That's the conversation that we need to keep confidential. We need to keep their confidence, right? Because we need them to feel comfortable to talk to us so that we can do our jobs well. So,
and this is where you can also talk to us in confidence. So if the PI approaches you and says, what would happen if I was leaving? There's nothing that prevents you from talking to us as well at that time. We are bound to confidentiality as well in OSR. So it's not as if we're going to turn around, we're going to talk to the chairs or talk to the ADRs and say, hey, did you know this guy might be leaving? So again, we're there to support you, and we will maintain that confidentiality if you say the PI has not notified anybody about this. They're just looking into scenarios, what would happen, what could be done. We're there to help for that as well.
And absolutely, what we do in OSR is we always return to the PI, usually in writing, to say, you know, please confirm that you have who you have notified of this. And if they say, yeah, everybody knows, then we proceed and we may contact the other institution, we may follow up. But we don't take any of those steps until we have confirmation from the PI that everybody's aware. Now, what other things need to be considered? Ownership of equipment. Ownership must be relinquished by current institution and accepted by McGill prior to any equipment being moved. And again, it may involve risk management or insurance. So if you have any questions about that, you should contact them. This is important, too, because just as we're having issues tracking our equipment, that people move things without knowing, other institutions have that same problem. So if we can do our counterparts a favor and make sure that the process is followed there as well as here, it makes everybody's lives easier. So it's good to make the PIs aware of that obligation. I mean, some institutions do have clear processes on moving equipment, but others do not. McGill is one of the ones that doesn't have a clear policy on that. Gaps in award closeout and new award authorization, Marlene's already talked about that, but essentially, it will take, you can assume, 3 to 6 months. 3 months if we have everything in order and it's a very easy process. For example, the ones that are the easiest to transfer are the ones that have, for whatever reason, the transfer occurs directly on the new installment payment. So what the agency will do is they'll issue the next installment to the new institution and then have the award close out done behind the scenes, and then issue the unspent balance after. Those ones can be done quite quickly, but for the most part, nobody moves institutions April 1st. So it's rare that this happens, that it actually lines up that way. And if the research involves human subjects, animal subjects, and/or biohazards, an approval from the applicable McGill-affiliated office will be required. So it's often they will show the protocol from their previous institution. Well, they still have to contact the office at McGill to discuss next steps and see what's required. New funding. PI may be eligible to apply for research funding via McGill prior to appointment start date. Contact OSR for details. So at this time of year, the recruitment process is usually underway by now. Researchers may intend to come, so they may want to apply for an NSERC Discovery Grant, a SHRC Insight Grant in the fall, but they may not be here yet. There are options that we can often find ways to let them, to have them apply via McGill so that they can secure funding for when they actually are here. As a general rule, they need to take up the appointment by the start date of the funding, but NSERC allows until September. So there's some leeway there on when their appointment start date has to happen. And a few resources for new faculty. So if you're going to sit down with new faculty and have a little conversation about research administration, there's the new faculty guide, which is created by the Academic Personnel Office. This is really helpful. Although it's circulated, most PIs claim they've never seen it. So it's very helpful. It explains everything, you know, how you get an ID card, how, you know, how the library works, all those things. Office of Sponsored Research, we have a table of agency programs. This is a quick reference tool for tri-agency and FRQ programs. It's updated in the summer of each year. And then the funding opportunities listserv, email notices of upcoming funding opportunities. I believe all new researchers, once they're set up with a McGill account, are subscribed to that. However, you may want to make them aware that that's a resource that's there. Research personnel rates of pay and McGill indirect cost policy, that's something to always discuss. New faculty orientation sessions. OSR, so APO organizes some, but OSR organizes research administration specific ones, and they're usually held at the end of August, early September. Invitations are sent around to all new faculty. And then the financial services, there's the four researchers website, and then there's the knowledge base. And I linked to how to request an expense reimbursement because that's the usually the one that most people, they show up with a receipt and say, how do I get reimbursed? That's the one that they need to be aware of. I mean, even more senior PIs that are from, that have been doing research for a long time, it doesn't necessarily mean that they exactly know how to get an expense reimbursed via McGill. They may know roughly what needs to happen, they may know the agency parameters, you know, all that stuff, but the, you know, the actual completing the form and submitting the receipt, they may not know where to go, they may not know what to do, so keep that in mind. Scenario four is McGill is recipient of a sub-award, but lead PI will be changing institutions. In this case, we curl up in a corner and cry. because you would think that this, because, okay, so here we are, and you would think that this is just, you know, bloop, and then everything runs as normal. It is not just a quick little flip of an institution. What has to happen is, okay, so U of T, let's say they're leaving U of T and they're taking up U of A, U of T has to close, will have to terminate effective the resignation date. They'll do fund closeout and terminate all these subs. So we have to close out the accounts here, issue unspent balances back to U of T, who then gives it to the sponsor, who then considers the request, gives it all back to U of A, and then U of A can issue subs to all the places. So we do our best. As I said, experience has shown that you curl up in a corner and you cry. Same thing. Actually, if we are the lead and it's transferring, we also have to close out all the subs. So that's something that does take time. In these cases, we do have to create a new PT record and we create a new fund number because this one's closed out. A new fund number gets created, and hopefully, the process is hopefully on paper seamless in that this one will terminate the 31st of September, this one will start October 1st, or 31st of March, this will start April 1st. However, although it's on paper that way, it can take 6 months before they actually get to sending anything to McGill. So what we will do is we will often return to the new institution to say, okay, we understand that the grant is transferring. Can you provide us confirmation that you will be issuing back? If we have sent, $30,000 as unspent balance to the University of Toronto, can you confirm that we will get that back? And if they confirm that, yes, the intention is that we will get it back, we will do our best to advance approve the creation of that new fund so that the researchers will at least have access, the gap will be as small as possible. We can't guarantee there won't be a gap because it's just how it works, but we do our best to make sure that we can make it seamless for our PI. However, it's not really seamless because they will get a new fund number. So it means for appointments and things like that, they will have to they will have to redo them so that they're charged to the new fund rather than the old fund. What I'm looking at, Cindy. So what we often do is we will close out the account and return the unspent balance, but we won't actually freeze that account. So the researcher, until this account is ready, we will leave that account open, but it's McGill's advanced spending cost, so it's no longer agency money. If something happens and the University of Alberta doesn't issue us that money, that's money that McGill has to absorb now. But we do our best to ensure that it's seamless. However, it's rarely actually seamless. So I keep saying we do our best. This is a case where we do our best, and all the institutions are in the same boat. So if someone who's a recipient of a sub-award knows anything about a PI leaving or transferring the grant, let us know as soon as possible, because often we don't find out until we receive the amendment terming our sub. And then we ask, okay, why is it being cut in the middle of the year? And they say, well, actually, the grant's being closed out and moved to Alberta. And that's how we find out. Now, I've already kind of explained this. So McGill recipient of a sub-award, but lead PI will be moving institutions. So there's two processes that have to follow. And we have to do the fund closeout on one and then a new fund on the other. And there are separate, there would be a new sub-award agreement and everything like that. It's exceptionally rare that we would be allowed to keep the same, like keep the money while the other institutions are transferred. They make the money go back, everything's all put together, then they move it to the new institution, then they move it all back. As far as the tri-agencies used to require that we send it all back to the tri-agencies, but do they still do that, or do we send it to... It depends. Yeah, sometimes they will say, even though you know it's going to University of Toronto, you have to give it to SHRC, who then gives it to University of Toronto. And so it's a very long process. Sometimes they will say, yeah, please mail a check of this amount to University of Toronto, but it's rare. Usually they will say it has to come back here. We accept it and deposit it, then we repay it. So it's a very long process. We do our best to make it seem like it's a very long process, but it doesn't necessarily have to be a long process for the PI. We can make it so that all this stuff is happening behind the scenes and we're monitoring it, but their research activities are able to continue. So considerations when the PI is relocating. Will any McGill-owned equipment or research materials be moved? If so, has proper authorization to move the equipment been obtained? If the research program involves human subjects, animal subjects, and/or biohazards, have the appropriate offices been notified? It's often that the ethics offices, just like us, do not get notified when PIs leave. Will data be brought to new institution? If so, a material transfer agreement may be required. Contact OSR for more details. If data continues to be used by McGill students, will it remain accessible to them? Have all technical reports been submitted to the sponsor? Have all supporting document, this one's important given that we always talk about supporting documentation, have all supporting documentation related to financial transactions been placed in the central local repository? So this is important. Even if the grant's been transferred to, and that was the example I was giving, University of Toronto, we remain responsible for the grant up until the date when we ceased, like up until the resignation date. So we have to ensure that we have all the documentation related to transactions that happened during our custody of that grant. Does the PI have any unrestricted research residual funds, is what Marlene was talking about? Those discussions also have to take place at the Department of Faculty. Or what's happening with that money? Is it going back into the departmental account? Is this person going to have access to it? Those conversations need to happen as well. So we created, on the Research Administration Toolbox, a PI departure checklist, which is borrowed from a bunch of U.S. institutions that do a really good job of this. So it's a little tool. Oh, I don't want to sign it. It's a tool that you can use. I mean, it's not an official document by any means, but it's a tool that we can use to help make sure that all the steps are covered when a PI is leaving. So... Yeah. This is a big step for us. If I can just say one thing that's super important is the contact email that's not the McGill.ca email address, because those get deactivated at a certain point, and it doesn't necessarily send an error message that's been deactivated. So you could be trying to contact the PI and not getting any response. So even in this case, even if they have a Gmail account, or, you know, if they don't have their new institutional address yet, a Gmail account somewhere that we know that this person is going to be reachable at. Just to quickly fly through, the resignation letter submitted, effective date for resignation confirmed. That's an important one, because for some reason people put in the resignation letter, like, I'm resigning in September, I'll be taking up a position October 1st, but they don't necessarily confirm exactly what their resignation date is. Sometimes there's an overlap. I saw a case recently where the new position took up October 1st, but they didn't actually resign from McGill until later. So, you know, they need to confirm that date so that we can process and we can assess the awards. PI's research personnel notified. That was what we were talking about with the Canada Research, with the example of the postdocs. That would be the PI and the department to NHR to talk to those students, or research personnel, excuse me. Committee memberships notified. So if the PI sits on any institutional committees, that they are aware that this person is no longer there. We put it as the PI's responsibility, but it's a good idea to remind them of that obligation. OSR notified, McGill staff directory updated, forwarding address confirmed. A lot of agencies as well, they will ask for forwarding. They will ask for the new contact information from the PI, and often we don't have that, so it's good to have. Now, onto the research administration matters. Each grant contract assessed, what's going to happen? So we ask that the PI with the department sit down, get their list of active awards, and figure out what they want to do with each one. At the same time, they need to determine how much money they need until their departure date. Do they need all their money? If not, do they need all their grants active now? Can we term some, if their grant's going to be terminated or contract's going to be terminated, can we do it early? Is that acceptable? If they need more money than they're going to actually have, that's something that we need to know about as well. The agencies sometimes need to get involved. And then disposition of each grant contract discussed with awards OSR. And then these are the options. So there's award termination in case of non-transferable awards, award transfer, that's sponsor specific, awards remaining at McGill, and pending awards. This is important, too, that the sponsors and OSR are notified, because it sometimes happens that we get a notice that these grants have been awarded, and then when we look, that researcher no longer is here. But the agency is about to pay us. So in that case, the researcher, the PI, should contact the agency as soon as possible to say, just so you know, I'm no longer there. I'm located at this institution. If the grant is awarded, I would like this institution paid. Because it happened a few times where we got paid for an award that the researcher was no longer here. And if we get paid, we have to send it back. You know, it's a lot easier if we can catch it before the agency pays us, because it makes it a lot easier for everybody. All technical reports submitted and confirmed with OSR, financial reports submitted for research funds. By confirmed with OSR for the technical reports, we don't necessarily need a copy of the report. We just want to make sure that the PI confirms in writing that, yes, I've submitted all my obligations have been fulfilled on these funds. Equipment, talked about that already. So inventory of lab contents and confirmation of next steps for McGill-owned equipment. And then research compliance, if they have any protocols, they need to assess those. And OSR commercialization notified of any of intellectual property implications. If there's any, keep in mind that McGill's IP policy is that McGill owns IP, so therefore if there's any IP that will be moving, or, you know, potential IP moving, the OSR commercialization office needs to be involved in that conversation to ensure that McGill... because McGill is the owner, McGill needs to be in that conversation. Financial compliance, P-card cancelled, approval authority for financial transactions removed, cash advances returned or reconciled, and all supporting documentation related to financial transactions on research funds transferred to central local repository, and then signatures. You can either sign it yourself, you can have the PI sign, whatever you want to do. We didn't dictate who needs to sign it. So this should be a helpful resource, and given that we purposely put this presentation at this time of the year, because in the next few months, this is when most of those inquiries come in, a lot of departures happen around between July 1st and September, So this is a resource that will, both the session as well as this checklist, will hopefully make it a lot easier moving forward to assess these the next steps. And with that, I turn it over for any questions.
Again, for the departure list, this checklist,
it's a
living document.
Oops.
So we ask that as people start using it, and if you see suggestions, edits, comments, additions, let us know, because we really want this to be an interactive tool. We just put it together, like, literally.
Last night.
so we understand that it may need to be edited as we move along. But it's also something that we need your help to move this into the departments and the faculties, because we, again, don't interact with HR people. We don't interact with the faculties all that much. So we really need your help to move this forward and let people know that it's a tool that exists.
Yeah, and if you see anything that should be added, that you, as you start using it, if you think that other fields should be added, let me know, and we'll definitely revise. Any questions on anything, really, if you have any research administration questions? Any scenarios that we didn't cover? I think it's most of the cases. Yes?
It's not a scenario, but I'm just curious. When a grant, say a Tri-Council grant, gets transferred from another institution to McGill, say like an NSERC discovery grant,
yes,
halfway through, what happens to the indirect cost for that? Is it kind of prorated?
Yeah, it's based on what we were actually paid. So the institution that previously had it would get it would be accounted as part of their calculations for the years in which they were paid. And then once we were paid, it would count in our calculations. But keep in mind the indirect costs and the federal indirect costs, it's 3 years behind. So they would likely get the indirect costs right now, and then we would get it once the years that we were paid come into the calculation. That makes sense? And that's the same for any grants with indirect costs, like where there's indirect costs recovered right off the grant. We would only be recovering what's paid to us. The other institution would be keeping what was entitled to them.
And it's actually a really good point, though, that when transferring grants from one institution to the other.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot about that. It's really a indirect. Where, again, if you're dealing with.
Here, do you want to get up on the.
Can people hear me?
I'm not sure
they'll hear me.
Okay.
It's the volume. that if you're transferring grants that are not accredited, that actually we collect actively the indirects, then if it's coming from, I don't know, UBC, and their indirect rate on grants is 20%, ours is 15, or ours is on contracts, ours is 40, theirs is 30. Those kind of things need to be reassessed, looked at to, again, at the time those grants are transferring in or transferring back. NIH grants that are coming to and from in the U.S., they have their own indirects rate. Here we're limited to 8%. So oftentimes these budgets need to be reworked and reassessed. So, again, I think it's the indirect cost is something that we definitely need to be considering as we're moving these grants around.
Yeah, and if there's a big discrepancy, it would be discussed at the departmental level, likely at the time of recruitment,
right,
award setup.
Yeah, depending on what we can and can't do. I mean, yes, we would have to assess that if our indirect rates are higher, do we agree to reduce? Because normally we try to avoid having the direct cost that the PI had initially budgeted impacted. It is their direct cost. We try to avoid impact to that as much as we can. It is, if the indirect rate was higher at the other institution, lower here, then we might adjust and we might say, okay, we'll give you, you know, there might be an increase in their direct cost. Those are things that we're going to need to look on a case-by-case basis.
And I guess in currency, too, though, it's like going back to the previous, that currency needs to be taken into consideration, too, if they're transferring in grants and they're not from Canada, so they're not used to Canadian currency. For the most part, because the U.S. dollar is now worth quite a bit more than the Canadian dollar, it would be just more money. But, yeah, that's something they need to consider as well. Any other questions? Yes.
Award gets prorated per agency. Like, for example, usually the tri-council is April to March, and let's say the professor usually leaves as of September.
Mm-hmm.
So does he, how do we know how much,
yes.
How does the budget get?
That's a great question. I forgot. You're really good. You're bringing up things that we forgot to include in the presentation. Technically, in the case of the tri-agency, so let's say there was an NSERC discovery, they had another installment coming to them April 1st, and then they leave in August. The agencies do consider April 1st to be that full entitlement. It's not prorated necessarily. So if the researcher spends the 100% of that installment year, it is acceptable within the guidelines. So if they, by the time they leave in August, they elect to use all that grant, they could. If they don't, I mean, anything just gets returned to the agency. But that's how it works. We had a case recently where the researcher left, and because they left, I think, in December, so the next installment was due in April, but they had actual for the ongoing commitments, they had them going into the next fiscal year. The agency did pay more money in that case. They did say, okay, so we will let you expend the full balance until March 31st, and then April 1st, you will get this extra little bit, because specifically for the ongoing commitment, because we stated an ongoing commitment that exceeded the unspent balance, they did allow a payment to go through in the next fiscal year. So we will be getting a little payment in April to cover off that ongoing commitment. So there's that.
Is this just for research, or
does that apply to? It's all of them. It's a case by case, though. I would never say count on more money being paid in the next fiscal year. If the case is made, if it's a student salary and it's clear that there's no money to pay that unless we get an installment April 1st, then they may elect to offer us that option. It's not guaranteed, though. Most of the time, I would recommend keeping the ongoing commitment within the unspent balance. But in this case, it was unique because the departure happened just before, in the months before the next installment was expected. Does that answer the question? Okay. Any other questions? Yes?
I have a question for you. When you were talking about the researchers moving their equipment, is there any restrictions on how long has to be within the guild before they can move it?
They just purchased it and now they're moving it? No, I don't think so. I mean, it's a departmental conversation that needs to happen, but no. I mean,
I would say that on average, if the grant or contract is still active and they're going to be moving that research project to the other institution, most of the time the agencies are going to expect you that you will let that equipment go, because they're not going to want to pay for it again because it was charged to that grant.
Hmm.
So I anticipate that the agency would want us to let it go. It's when the grants are termed, the project is done, and that equipment is being used for other projects, then that's where the discussion is really between the PI, the chairs, and the deans to say, do we let it go or do we keep it because we may have other needs for it. There's other research programs happening in the unit, in the department, whatever, that could use this equipment. But if it's still active, I would think that a lot of agencies would anticipate that we would let it go.
Yeah, as Marlene said, if the grant has completed, the grant that was used to purchase the equipment, at that point it pretty much, and this is in the eyes of the agency, becomes fully McGill equipment. That's McGill equipment. The PI, we can elect to have to let the PI have it, but it's McGill's decision completely at that point.
I mean, I don't know, this is where I'm my knowledge of tri-agency is not all up to par, but I based on my U.S. experience, is that the equipment vests with the institution as soon as it's purchased, but the granting agency can always claw it back. As long as the research project is active, they can claw it back and basically force you as an institution to give it back to another institution. So again, they don't want to have to pay for the equipment again. It's already been purchased from that grant. The person's moving with the research program. We really should let it go.
The tri-agencies wouldn't claw it back, but they would because they do see it as an institutional responsibility. However, they would send an email saying, you know, it would be strongly recommend, you know, we strongly support that this application, you know, that this request be accepted. That's as far as I think they would go, but yeah. Any other questions, comments? All right, well, thanks very much for coming. Oh, and if you have any questions you want to talk in confidence, don't hesitate to come to me.